Chapter 21. A sudden summer storm had come howling in off of the Great Western Sea 2 days after the fight on the cliffs. It raked the island with shrieking winds and sheets of rain rattling the windows of the council chamber high in the south tower. The bone-thin Javelin, who had arrived with the others aboard the Seabird that morning, slouched in his chair looking out at the raging storm and thoughtfully tapping his fingers together.
"Where did the trail finally lead?" he asked.
"Right down to the water's edge in a secluded cove."
"Then I think we will have to assume that this abductor made a clean escape with the prince. The timing might have been a little tight, but the men aboard the ships that were patrolling the coast would have been concentrating on the shoreline, and a ship that had gotten well out to sea before they arrived could have escaped their notice."
Barak was piling an armload of logs in the cavernous fireplace.
"Why were those others left behind then?" he asked. "It doesn't make any sense at all."
"We're talking about bear cultists, Barak. They are not supposed to make sense." "There's a certain logic to it, though," the Earl of Selene pointed out. "If what the cultist said before he died is true, this Ilfgar has declared war on Belgarion. Isn't it entirely possible that those men were left behind, specifically to waylay him? One way or another, he was certain to follow that trail."
"There is still something that doesn't quite ring true," Javelin frowned. "Let me think about it for a bit."
"We can sort out their motives later. The important thing right now is to find out where they have taken my son."
"Rehan, most likely," Unheg said. "We destroyed Jarviksholm. Rehan's the only strong point that they've got left."
"That's not entirely certain, Unheg," Queen Porin disagreed. "The scheme to abduct Prince Garen was obviously planned quite some time ago, and you destroyed Jarviksholm only last week. It is unlikely that the abductors even knew about it. I don't think we can rule out the possibility that the prince was taken to Carrick."
Anheg rose and began pacing up and down, a dark scowl on his face.
"Well, she's got a point," he admitted finally. "These child stealers were Carricks after all. It's quite possible that they tried to take him to Jarviksholm. But when they found the city destroyed, they'd still have to go someplace else. We could very well find them holed up in a fishing village somewhere on the west coast."
"Well, what do we do now, then?" Garion asked helplessly.
"We split up," King Kohag said quietly. "Unheg turns out all his forces, and they search every village and every farm in Carrick. The rest of us go to Rehan and deal with those people there."
"There's only one difficulty with that," Anheg said. "A baby is a baby. How do my men recognize Garion's son if they do run across him?"
"That's no real problem, Anheg," Poldra told him from her chair by the fire. She was sitting and sipping a cup of tea. "Show them your palm, Garion." Garion held up his right hand to show the King of Carrick the silvery mark there.
"Oh, I'd almost forgotten that. Does Prince Garon have the same mark?"
"All heirs to the Riven Throne have that mark on their palms. It has been that way since the birth of Iron Grip's first son."
"All right. My men will know what to look for then. But will the rest of you have enough men to take to Rehan? With the Algar and Drasnian cultists there, Ulfgar's got quite an army."
General Brendig rose and went over to a large map tacked up on one of the walls.
"If I leave immediately for Sindar, I can put together a sizable army in a few days. The first march could put us in Dareen within a week."
"I'll have ships waiting there to ferry you and your men to Boktor then."
"I will go south and raise the clans," Hetar added. "We will ride straight north to Rehan."
Garion was also peering at the map.
If Anheg's ships take me and my troops to Boktor, we can join with the Drasnian pikemen there and march toward Rehan from the west. Then the ships can go back to Darin and pick up Brendig.
That would save some time, Brendig agreed.
With the Rivens and Drasnians, you're going to have enough troops to encircle Rehan, Silk said. You might not have enough men to take the city, but you will have enough to keep anybody from going in or out. Then all you have to do is sit and wait for Brendig and Hetar. Once they join you, you will have an overwhelming force.
It sounds like a plan, Geryon, Beric said approvingly.
Mandarallon stood up.
And when we arrive at this fortified city on the moors of eastern Drasnia, I will undertake with siege engines and diverse other means to weaken the walls, so that we may more easily gain access when we make our final assault. Rehan will fall, and we will bring this miscreant Ulfgar to swift and terrible justice.
Not too swift, I hope, Hetar murmured. I was thinking along the lines of something more lingering.
We'll have time to think about that after we catch him, Marek said.
The door opened, and Senedra, pale and wan-looking, and accompanied by Queen Layla and the other ladies, entered.
Why aren't you still here? She demanded. Why aren't you taking the world apart to find my baby?
That's hardly fair, Senedra, Geryon chided her gently.
I am not trying to be fair. I want my baby.
So do I, but we're not going to accomplish much by dashing around in circles, are we?
I will raise an army myself if I have to, she declared. I did it before, and I can certainly do it again.
And just where would you take them, dear?
Wherever it is that they've got my baby.
And where is that? Asked Balgara. If you know something that we don't, shouldn't you share it with us? Senedra stared at her helplessly, her eyes filling with tears. Belgareth had not contributed anything to the discussions, but rather had sat brooding out at the storm from a deep cushioned chair near the window.
I have got the feeling I'm missing something, he muttered as Adara and Nerina led the distraught Senedra to a chair near the council table.
What did you say, Belgareth?
Anheg asked, removing his dented crown and tossing it on the table.
I said that I think I'm missing something, the old man replied. Anheg, just how extensive is your library?
The Kerak king shrugged, scratching at his head.
I don't know that I could match the university library at Tol Harnath, but I've gathered most of the significant books in the world.
How does your collection stack up in the area of the mysteries?
Of what?
Prophecies. Not so much the Mrin Codex or the Darin, but the others. The Gospels of the Seers at Kel, the Grolem prophecies of Rachtal, the Oracles of Ashaba.
Well, I've got that one, Anheg told him. The Ashaba thing. I picked it up about a dozen years ago.
I think I had better go to Val'Alorn and have a look at it.
This is hardly the time for side trips, Grandfather, Geryon objected.
Geryon, we know that something is happening that goes beyond an insurrection by a group of religious fanatics. That passage you found in the Mrin Codex was very specific. It instructed me to look into the mysteries, and I think that if I don't do exactly that, we are all likely to regret it.
He turned to Anheg.
Where is your copy of the Ashabine Oracles?
In the library, up on the top shelf. I couldn't make any sense out of it, so I stuck it up there. I always meant to go back to it one day.
Then a thought occurred to him.
Oh, by the way, there's a copy of the Malorian Gospels in the monastery at Marteran.
Belgareth blinked.
That's one of the other books you wanted to see, wasn't it? The one by the Seers of Kel?
How could you possibly know what is in the library at Marteran?
I heard about it a few years back. I have people who keep their eyes open for rare books for me. Anyway, I made the monk an offer for it. Quite generous, I thought. But the negotiations fell through. You are a positive sink of information, Anheg. Can you think of anything else? I can't help you with the Grolem prophecies of Rakhtul, I'm afraid. The only copy I know of was in Tuchik's library, and that was probably buried when you blew Rakhtul off the mountaintop. You could go dig for it, I suppose. Thanks, Anheg, Belgarath said dryly. You have no idea how much I appreciate your help.
I cannot believe that I am hearing this,
Tenedra said accusingly to Belgarath.
Someone has stolen my baby. Your great-grandson, and instead of trying to find him, you are planning to go off chasing obscure manuscripts?
I am not abandoning the child, Tenedra. I am just looking for him in a different place, that's all.
He looked at her with a great sympathy in his eyes.
You are still very young, and all you can see is the one reality that your baby has been taken from you. There are two kinds of reality, however. Garrigan is going to follow your child in this reality. I'm going to follow him in the other. We are all after the same thing, and this way, we cover all of the possibilities.
She stared at him for a moment, and then she suddenly covered her face with her hands and began to cry. Garrigan rose, went to her, and put his arms around her.
Ah, Tenedra. Tenedra, it's going to be all right.
Nothing will be all right. I am so afraid for the baby, Garrigan. Nothing will ever be all right again.
Mandarallan rose to his feet, tears standing in his eyes.
As I am thy true knight and champion, dearest Tenedra, I vow upon my life that this villain, Ulfgar, will never see another summer.
That sort of gets to the point, Hetar murmured. Why don't we all go to Rion and nail Ulfgar to a post someplace with very long nails?
Anheg looked at Kohag. Your son has a remarkably firm grasp of the realities of the situation, he observed.
He is the delight of my twilight years, Kohag said proudly.
The argument with Tenedra began immediately upon their return to the royal apartment. Garrigan tried reasoning with her first, then commanding. Finally, he resorted to threats.
I don't care what you say, Garrigan. I am going to Rian.
You are not.
I am so?
I will have you locked in this bedroom.
And as soon as you will leave, I will order someone to unlock the door. I will chop it down, and I will be on the next boat out of the harbor.
Tenedra, it's too dangerous.
So was Tulmardu and Tulmeshrak, and I did not flinch from either one. I am going to Rayon, Garrigan, either with you or by myself. I am going to get my baby back, even if I have to tear down the city walls with my bare hands.
Tenedra, please.
No,
she exclaimed, stamping her foot.
I'm going, Garrigan, and nothing you can say or do is going to stop me.
Garrigan threw his arms in the air. Women, he said in a despairing tone. The fleet left at dawn the following morning, sailing out of the harbor into rough seas and the dirty scud and rack of the tail end of the storm. Garrigan stood on the aft deck of the Seabird, beside Barak, whose thick hands firmly grasped the tiller.
I didn't think I was ever going to have to do this again, he said morosely.
Oh, sailing in rough weather isn't all that bad,
Barak shrugged as the wind tossed his red beard. Oh, that's not what I meant. I thought that after Torak died, I could live out my life in peace.
You got lucky, Barak told him.
Are you trying to be funny?
All anybody ever got out of peace was a fat behind and cobwebs in his head, the big man said sagely. Give me a nice friendly little war any time.
When they were some leagues at sea, a detachment of ships,
separated from the fleet to sail due east toward Sindar, bearing with them King Tholrak, General Brendig, the Earl of Selene, and the heavily sedated Queen Layla.
"I hope Brendig gets to Darin on time," Anhig said, standing at the rail. "I'm really going to need those ships during the search."
"Where do you plan to start?"
Queen Poran asked him.
"The coast largely concentrated on the west coast. If Prince Garen's abductors went to Kerik, they'd most likely head for a cult stronghold. I'll start along the coast and work my way inland."
"That seems like sound strategy,"
she agreed.
"Deploy your men and sweep the area."
"Poran," he said with a pained look, "I love you like a sister, but please don't use military terms when you talk to me. It still sets my teeth on edge to hear that sort of language in a woman's mouth."
The passage through the Kerik Bor delayed them for 2 days. Although Greldik and a few other hardy souls were willing, even eager, to attempt the great maelstrom in the heavy seas that were the aftermath of the storm, cooler and more prudent heads prevailed.
"I'm sure that the sea will quiet down in a bit," Barak shouted across to his friend. "And Rayhon isn't going any place. Let's not lose any ships, if we don't have to."
"Barak," Greldik shouted back, "you're turning into an old woman."
"Anhig said the same thing just before Jarviksholm," Barak noted.
"He was a wise king."
"It isn't his ship."
After they passed the Boar and entered the calmer waters of the Gulf of Kerik, King Anhug took a sizable portion of the fleet and sailed northward toward Val Alorn, before making the transfer to one of Anhug's ships. Bulgarath stood on the deck, talking quietly with Geryon and Pulgara.
"As soon as I finish at Val Alorn, I will go on down to Mar Terran. If I don't get back before you arrive at Rayon, be careful. The cult's pretty fanatic, and this war they have started is directed at you personally, Geryon."
"I will watch out for him, father,"
Pulgara assured him.
"I can more or less take care of myself, Aunt Paul," Geryon told her.
"I'm sure you can, dear, but old habits die hard. How old am I going to have to be before you realize that I'm grown up? Why don't you check back with me in 1,000 years or so? Maybe we can talk about it then."
He smiled, then sighed.
"Aunt Paul, I love you."
"Yes, dear," she replied, patting his cheek. "I know, and I love you too."
At Kotu, the ship carrying Hetar and his wife and parents turned south toward Alderford.
"I will meet you at Rayhan in about 3 weeks,"
the hawk-faced Algar called across to the seabird.
"Save a little bit of the fighting for me."
"Only if you hurry,"
Laldoran shouted back blithely.
"I'm not sure which are worse," Polgra murmured to Senedra. "Erin's or Alorn's?"
"Could they possibly be related?"
Senedra asked. Aunt Paul laughed, then wrinkled her nose as she looked at the wharves of Kotu.
"Come, dear, let's go below. Harbors always have the most distressing odors about them."
The fleet passed Kotu and filed into the mouth of the Mrin River. The current was sluggish and the fens lay green and soggy on either side. Geryon stood near the bow of the seabird, idly watching the gray-green reeds and the scrubby bushes sliding past as the oarsmen pulled steadily upstream.
"Ah, there you are, Geryon," Queen Poran said, coming up behind him. "I thought we might talk for a few minutes."
"Of course." He had a rather special feeling for this small blonde woman, whose courage and devotion bespoke at once an enormous affection and an iron-clad resolve.
"When we reach Boktor, I want to leave Kiva at the palace. I don't think he's going to like it very much, but he's just a little young for battles. If he gets stubborn about it, could you order him to stay behind?"
"Me?"
"You are the overlord of the West, Geryon. I am only his mother."
Overlord of the West is an overrated title, I'm afraid. He tugged absently at one ear. I wonder if I could possibly persuade Sinedra to stay in Boktor as well, he mused. I doubt it. Kiva might accept you as his superior, but Sinedra looks upon you as her husband. There is a difference, you know.
He made a wry face. Ah, you're probably right, he admitted. It's worth a try, though.
How far up the Mrin can we go by boat? The North Fork runs into a series of shallows about 20 leagues above Boktor. I suppose we could portage around them, but it wouldn't accomplish very much. 10 leagues further upstream you come to another stretch of shallows, and then there are the rapids. We could spend a great deal of time pulling the boats out of the water, and then putting them back in again.
Then it would be faster just to start marching when we get to the first shallows? She nodded.
It is likely to take several days for my generals to assemble their troops and get their supplies together. I will instruct them to follow us as quickly as they can. Once they join us, we can go on to Rehan and lay siege until Brendig and Hetar arrive. You know, you are really very good at this, Porin.
She smiled sadly.
Rodar was a very good teacher. You loved him very much, didn't you?
She sighed then.
More than you can possibly imagine, Geryon.
They reached Boktor the following afternoon, and Geryon accompanied Queen Porin and her slightly sullen son to the palace, with Silk tagging along behind. As soon as they arrived, Porin sent a messenger to the headquarters of the Drasnian military forces.
"Shall we take some time for tea while we are waiting, gentlemen?"
the little blonde queen offered as the three of them sat comfortably in a large airy chamber with red velvet drapes at the windows.
"Only if you can't find anything stronger," Silk replied with an impudent grin.
"Is it not a trifle early in the day for that, Prince Keldar?"
she asked him reprovingly.
"I'm an Alorn, Auntie dear. It's never too early in the day."
"Keldar, please don't call me that. It makes me feel positively antique."
"But you are, Porin, my aunt. I mean, not antique, of course."
"Are you ever serious about anything?"
"Oh, not if I can help it."
She sighed and then laughed a warm tinkle of a laugh. Perhaps a quarter of an hour later, a stocky man with a red face and a somewhat gaudy orange uniform was shown into the room.
"Your Majesty sent for me?" he asked, bowing respectfully.
"Ah, General Haldar," she replied. "Are you acquainted with His Majesty, King Belgarian?"
"We met briefly, ma'am, at your late husband's funeral." He bowed floridly to Geryon. "Your Majesty."
"General?" "And of course you have met Prince Keldar."
"Of course," the general replied. "Your Highness."
"General," Silk looked at him closely, "isn't that a new decoration, Haldar?"
The red-faced general touched the cluster of medals on his chest somewhat deprecatingly.
"That's what generals do in peacetime, Prince Keldar. We give each other medals."
"I'm afraid that the peacetime is at an end, General Haldar,"
Porin said rather crisply.
"You have heard what happened at Jarviksholm in Kerrick, I presume."
"Yes, Your Majesty. It was a well-executed campaign."
"We are now going to proceed against Rehan. The Bear Cult has abducted King Belgarion's son."
"Abducted?"
Haldar's expression was incredulous.
"I am afraid so. I think the time has come to eliminate the cult entirely. That is why we are moving to Rehan. We have a fleet in the harbor loaded with Belgarion's ravens. Tomorrow, we will sail up to the shallows and disembark. We will march overland to Rehan. I want you to muster the army and follow us as quickly as you possibly can."
Haldar was frowning as if something he had heard had distracted him.
"Are you sure that the Riven Prince was abducted, Your Majesty? He was not killed?"
"No,"
Geryon answered firmly.
"It was clearly an abduction."
Haldar began to pace up and down agitatedly.
"But that doesn't make any sense," he muttered almost to himself.
"Do you understand your instructions, General?"
Porin asked him. "What?" "Oh, yes, Your Majesty. I am to gather the army and catch up with King Belgarion's Rivens before they reach Rehan."
"Precisely. We will be joined at Rehan by Algars and elements of the Sundarian army."
"I will start at once, Your Majesty," he assured her.
His expression was still slightly abstracted, and his frown was worried.
"Is there anything wrong, General?"
"What? No, Your Majesty. I will go to headquarters and issue the necessary orders immediately."
"Thank you, General Haldar. That will be all."
"He certainly heard something he didn't like," Silk observed after the general had left.
"We've all heard things lately that we didn't like," Geryon added.
"It was not quite the same, though," Silk muttered. "Excuse me for a bit. I think I am going to go ask a few questions."
He rose from his chair and quietly left the room. Early the next morning, the fleet weighed anchor and began to move slowly upstream from Boktor. Though the day had dawned clear and sunny, by noon, a heavy cloud cover had swept in off of the Gulf of Kerik to turn the Drasnian countryside gray and depressing.
"I hope it doesn't rain," Beric growled from his place at the tiller. "I hate slogging through mud on my way to a fight."
The shallows of the Mrin proved to be a very wide stretch of river where the water rippled over gravel bars.
"Have you ever considered dredging this?"
Geryon asked the Queen of Drasnia.
"No,"
she replied.
"As a matter of policy, I don't want the Mrin navigable beyond this point. I would rather not have a Tolnedran merchantman bypassing Boktor."
She smiled sweetly at Tenedra.
"I'm not trying to be offensive, dear, but your countrymen always seem to want to avoid customs. As things now stand, I control the North Caravan route, and I need that customs revenue."
"I understand, Porin,"
Tenedra assured her. "I would do it that way myself."
They beached the fleet on the northern bank of the river, and Geryon's forces began to disembark.
"You lead the ships back down river and cross to Darin, then?"
Beric said to the bearded Greldic.
"Right," Greldic said. "I'll have Brintig and his centaurs back here within a week." "Good. Tell him to follow us to Rehan as quickly as he can. I've never been happy with the idea of long sieges."
"Are you going to send Seabird back with me?"
Beric scratched at his beard thoughtfully.
"No,"
he said finally.
"I think I'll leave her here."
"Believe me, I'm not going to get her sunk, Beric."
"I know, but I just feel better about the idea of having her here in case I need her. Will you come to Rehan with Brindig? There is bound to be some good fighting."
Greldic's face grew mournful.
"No. Anheg ordered me to come back to Val Alorn when I finish freighting the Sindars here." "Oh, that's too bad," Greldic grunted sourly. "Have fun at Rehan, and try not to get yourself killed. I will make a very special point of it."
By the time the troops and supplies had all been unloaded, it was late afternoon. The clouds continued to roll in, though there was as yet no rain.
"I think we may as well set up camp here," Geryon said to the others, as they all stood on the gently sloping riverbank. "We wouldn't get too far before dark anyway, and if we get a good night's sleep, we can start early in the morning."
"That makes sense," Silk agreed.
"Did you find out anything about Haldar?"
Queen Porin asked the rat-faced little man.
"I know there was something about him that was bothering you."
"Oh, nothing really very specific. He has been doing a lot of traveling lately, though."
"He is a general, Keldar, and my chief of staff. Generals do have to make inspection tours from time to time, you know."
"Yes, but usually not alone," Silk replied. "When he makes these trips, he doesn't even take his aide along."
"I think you are being just overly suspicious,"
It's my nature to be suspicious, Auntie dear. She stamped her foot. Will you stop calling me that?
He looked at her mildly.
Does it really bother you, Porin? I have told you that it bothers me. Maybe I ought to try to remember that, then. You are absolutely impossible, do you know that?
Of course I do, Auntie dear. For the next 2 days, the Riven army marched steadily eastward across the desolate gray-green moors, a wasteland of barren, sparsely vegetated hills, interspersed with rank patches of thorn and bramble, springing up around dark pools of stagnant water. The sky remained gray and threatening, but there was as yet no rain. Geryon rode at the head of the column with a bleakly determined look on his face. Speaking infrequently except to issue commands, his scouts reported at intervals, announcing that there was no sign of cult forces ahead, and with equal certainty, that there was as yet no evidence that the Drasnian pikemen under General Haldar were coming up from the rear. When they stopped for a hasty midday meal on that second day, Polgara approached him gravely. Her blue cloak seemed to whisper through the tall grass as she came, and her familiar fragrance came to him on the vagrant breeze.
"Let's walk a bit, Geryon," she said quietly. "There is something that we need to discuss."
"All right." His reply was short, even curt. She did something then that she had rarely done in the past several years. With a kind of solemn affection, she linked her arm in his, and together they walked away from the army and the rest of their friends, moving up a grassy knoll.
"You have grown very grim in the past few weeks, dear," she said, as they stopped at the crest of the knoll. "Well, I think I've got reason enough, Aunt Paul. I know that you have been hurt deeply by all of this, Geryon, and that you are filled with a great rage. But don't let it turn you into a savage.
Aunt Paul, I did not start this. They tried to kill my wife. Then they murdered one of my closest friends, and they tried to start a war between me and Anhag, and now they have stolen my son. Don't you think that a little punishment might be in order?"
"Perhaps," she replied, looking directly into his face. "But you must not allow your sense of outrage to run away with you and make you decide to start wading in blood. You have tremendous power, Geryon, and you could very easily use it to do unspeakable things to your enemies. If you do that, the power will turn you into something as vile as Torak. You'll begin to take pleasure in the horrors that you inflict. In time, that pleasure will come to own you."
He stared at her, startled by the intensity of her voice and by the way that single white lock at her brow seemed to blaze up suddenly.
"It is a very real danger, Geryon. In a peculiar way, you are in more peril right now than you were when you faced Torak. I'm not going to let them get away with what they have done," he said stubbornly. "I'm not just going to let them go." "I am not suggesting that you do, dear. We will be at Rayon soon, and there will be fighting. You are an Elorn, and I am sure that you will be very enthusiastic about the fighting. I want you to promise me that you will not let that enthusiasm and your sense of outrage push you over the line into wanton slaughter."
"Not if they surrender," he replied stiffly.
"And what then? What will you do with your prisoners?"
He frowned.
He had not really considered that. "For the most part, the Bear Cult is composed of the ignorant and the misguided. They are so obsessed with a single idea that they can't even comprehend the enormity of what they have done. Will you butcher them for stupidity? Stupidity is unfortunate, but it hardly deserves that kind of punishment."
"What about Ulfgar?" She smiled a bleak little smile.
"Now that," she said, "is another matter."
A large blue-banded hawk spiraled down out of the murky sky.
"Are we having a little family get-together?"
Belden asked harshly, even as he shimmered into his own form.
"Where have you been, Uncle?"
Aunt Paul asked him quite calmly.
"I left word with the twins for you to catch up with us."
"I just got back from Meloria," he grunted, scratching at his stomach. "Where's Belgarath?"
"At Val Alorn," she replied. "And then he is going on to Mar Terran. He's trying to follow the trail that is supposed to be hidden in the mysteries. You have heard about what's happened?"
"Most of it, I think. The twins showed me the passage that was hidden in the Mrin Codex, and I heard about the Riven Warder and Belgarion's son. You're moving against Rayon, right?"
"Naturally. That is the source of the infection."
The hunchback looked speculatively at Garion.
"Well, I'm sure you're an expert tactician, Belgarion, but your reasoning escapes me this time."
Garion looked at him blankly.
"You are moving to attack a superior force in a fortified city, right?"
"I suppose you could put it that way."
"Well, then why is more than half your army camped at the shallows of the Mrin, 2 days behind you? Don't you think you might need them?"
"What are you talking about, Uncle?"
"I thought I was speaking quite plainly. The Drasnian army is camped at the shallows. They don't show any signs of planning to move at any time in the near future. They're even fortifying their positions."
"That's impossible," he shrugged.
"Fly back and have a look for yourself."
"We had better go tell the others, Garion,"
Aunt Paul said gravely.
"Something has gone terribly wrong somewhere."
Chapter 22.
"What is that man thinking of?"
Queen Porin burst out in a sudden, uncharacteristic fury.
"I specifically ordered him to catch up with us."
Silk's face was bleak.
"I think we should have checked the inestimable General Halder's feet for that telltale brand," he said.
"You're not serious,"
Porin exclaimed. "He's deliberately disobeying your orders, Porin, and he is doing it in such a way as to endanger you and all the rest of us."
"Believe me, I will get to the bottom of this as soon as I get back to Bakhtor."
"Unfortunately, we're not going in that direction just now."
"Then I will go back to the shallows alone," she declared. "If necessary, I will relieve him of his command."
"No," he said firmly. "You won't."
She stared at him incredulously.
"Keldar, do you realize to whom you are speaking?"
"Perfectly, Porin. But it's too dangerous."
"It is my duty."
"No. Actually, your duty is to stay alive long enough to raise Kiva to be king of Drasnia."
She bit her lip.
"That is unfair, Keldar."
"Yes. Life is hard, Porin."
"He is right, Your Majesty,"
Javelin said.
"General Haldar has already committed treason by disobeying you. I don't think that he would hesitate to add your murder to the crime."
"We're going to need some men," Beric rumbled. "A few, anyway. Otherwise, we're going to have to stop and wait for Brendig."
Silk shook his head. "Haldar's camped at the shallows. If what we suspect is true, he can keep Brendig from ever disembarking his troops."
"Well?"
Zinedra demanded angrily.
"What do we do now?"
"I don't think we've got much choice," Beric said. "We'll have to turn around and go back to the shallows and arrest Haldar for treason. Then we turn around and come back with the pikemen."
"That could take almost a week."
"What other alternatives do we have? We have to have those pikemen."
"I think you're overlooking something, Beric," Silk said. "Have you noticed a slight chill in the air the last 2 days?"
"A little. In the mornings."
"We're in northeastern Drasnia. Winter comes very early up here."
"Winter? But it's only early autumn."
"We are a very long way north, my friend. We could get the first snowfall at any time now."
Barak started to swear. Silk motioned Javelin aside, and the two of them spoke together briefly.
"It is all falling apart, isn't it, Geryon?"
Tenedra said, her lower lip starting to tremble.
"We'll fix it, Tenedra," he said to her, taking her in his arms.
"But how?"
"I haven't quite worked that out yet."
"We are vulnerable, Geryon," Barak called seriously. "We're marching directly into cult territory with a vastly inferior force. We're wide open to ambush."
"I'll need somebody to scout on ahead," Belden added, looking up from the piece of cold meat he had been tearing at with his teeth.
He stuffed the rest of the chunk into his mouth and wiped his fingers on the front of his filthy tunic.
"I can be fairly unobtrusive, if I want to be."
"I'll take care of that, Uncle," Polgara told him. "Hetar's coming north with the Algar clans. Could you go to him and tell him what has happened? We need him as quickly as he can get here."
He gave her an appraising look, still chewing on the chunk of meat.
Not a bad idea, Paul. I thought that married life might have made your wits soft. But it looks as if it's only your behind that's getting flabby."
"Do you mind, Uncle?"
"I'd better get started."
He crouched, spread his arms, and shimmered into the form of a hawk.
"I'll be away for a few days," Silk said, coming back to join them. "We might be able to salvage this yet."
And then he turned on his heel and went directly to his horse.
"Where's he going?" Geryon asked Javelin.
"We need men," Javelin replied. "He's going after some."
"Porin,"
Polgara called, trying to look back down over her shoulder.
"Does it seem to you that I have been putting on a few extra pounds in the past months?"
Porin gently smiled.
"Of course not, Polgara. He was only teasing you."
Polgara, however, still had a slightly worried look on her face as she removed her blue cloak.
"I'll go on ahead," she told Geryon. "Keep your troops moving, but do not run. I don't want you to blunder into something before I have a chance to warn you."
Then she blurred, and the great snowy owl drifted away on soft, noiseless wings. Geryon moved his forces carefully after that, deploying them into the best possible defensive posture as they marched. He doubled his scouts and rode personally to the top of every hill, along the way searching the terrain ahead. The pace of their march slowed to be no more than 5 leagues a day. Though the delay fretted him, he felt that he had no real choice in the matter. Polgara returned each morning to report that no apparent dangers lay ahead, and then she flew away again on noiseless wings.
"How does she manage that?" Tenedra asked. "I don't think she's sleeping at all."
"Polkin, go for weeks without sleep," Durnik told her. "She'll be all right, if it doesn't go on for too long."
"Bulgarian," Erend said in his light voice, pulling his chestnut stallion in beside Geryon's mount. "You did know that we're being watched, didn't you?"
"What?"
"There are men watching us."
"Where?"
"Several places. They're awfully well hidden. And there are other men galloping back and forth between that town we're going to and the army back at the river."
"I don't like that very much," Barak said. "It sounds as if they're trying to coordinate something."
Geryon looked back over his shoulder at Queen Porin, who rode beside Zinedra.
"Would the Drasnian army attack us if Haldar ordered them to?"
"No,"
Queen Porin answered quite firmly. "The troops are absolutely loyal to me. They would refuse that kind of order."
"What if they thought you were being rescued?" Erend asked.
"Rescued?"
"That's what Ulfgar is suggesting," the young man replied. "The general's supposed to tell his troops that our army here is holding you prisoner."
"I think they would attack under those circumstances, Your Majesty," Javelin said. "And if the cult and the army catch us between them, we could be in the very deepest of trouble."
"What else can go wrong?" Geryon fumed.
"At least it is not snowing," Lothurin said. "Not yet, anyway."
The army seemed almost to crawl across the barren landscape as the clouds continued to roll ponderously overhead. The world seemed locked in a chill, colorless gray, and each morning the scum of ice lying on the stagnant pools was thicker.
"We are never going to get there at this rate, Geryon,"
Zinedra said impatiently one gloomy midday as she rode beside him. "If we get ambushed, we might not get there at all, Zinedra. I don't like this any more than you do, but I don't think we've really got much choice."
"I want my baby."
"So do I."
"Well, then do something."
"I'm open to suggestions."
"Can't you..."
She made a vague sort of gesture with one hand. He shook his head. "You know that there are limits to that sort of thing, Zinedra."
"Well, what good is it then?"
she demanded bitterly, pulling her gray riven cloak more tightly about her against the chill. The great white owl awaited them just over the next rise. She sat on a broken limb of a dead white snag, observing them with her unblinking golden eyes.
"Lady Polgara?"
Zinedra greeted her with a formal inclination of her head. Gravely, the white owl returned her a stiff little bow. Geryon suddenly laughed. The owl blurred and the air around it wavered briefly, then Polgara was there, seated sedately on the limb with her ankles crossed.
"What is so amusing, Geryon?"
"I've never seen a bird bow before. It just struck me as funny, that's all."
"Try not to let it overwhelm you, dear," she said primly. "Come over here and help me down."
"Yes, Aunt Paul." After he had helped her to the ground, she looked at him soberly.
"There is a large colt force lying in wait 2 leagues ahead of you."
"How large?"
"Half again as large as yours."
"We'd better go tell the others, then," he said grimly, turning his horse.
"Is there any way we could slip around them?"
Durnik asked after Polgara had told them of the cultists lying in ambush ahead of them.
"I don't think so, Durnik. They know why we are here, and I am sure we are being watched."
"We must needs attack them, then," Mandarallan asserted. "Our cause is just, and we must inevitably prevail."
"That's an interesting superstition, Mandarallan. But I'd prefer to have numbers on my side," said Barak.
The big man turned to Polgara.
"How are they deployed?" "What I mean is..."
"I know what the word means, Barak." She scraped a patch of ground bare with her foot and picked up a stick. "This trail we are following runs through a ravine that cuts through that low range of hills just ahead. At about the deepest part of the ravine, there are several gullies running up the sides. There are 4 separate groups of cultists, each one hiding in a different gully." She sketched out the terrain ahead with her stick. "They obviously plan to let us march right into the middle of them, and then attack us from all sides at once."
Durnik was frowning as he studied her sketch.
"We could easily defeat any one of those troops," he suggested, rubbing thoughtfully at one cheek. "All we really need is some way to keep the other 3 groups out of the fight."
"Well, that sort of sums it up," Barak said. "But I don't think they'll stay away just because they were not invited."
"No," the smith agreed. "So we'll probably have to put up some kind of barrier to prevent their joining in."
"You have thought of something, haven't you, Durnik?" Queen Porin observed.
"What manner of barrier could possibly keep these villains from rushing to the aid of their comrades?"
Durnik shrugged. "Fire'd probably work." Javelin shook his head and pointed at the low gorse bushes in the field beside them.
"Everything in this area is still green. I don't think it's going to burn very well."
Durnik smiled.
"It doesn't have to be a real fire."
"Could you do that, Polgara?"
Barak asked, his eyes coming alight. She considered it for a moment.
"Not in 3 places at once."
But there are 3 of us, Paul," the smith reminded her. "You could block 1 group with an illusion of fire. I could take the 2nd, and Geryon the 3rd. We could pin all 3 groups in their separate gullies, and
Then after we've finished with the first group, we can move on to the next.
He frowned slightly.
The only problem with that is, I'm not sure exactly how to go about creating the illusion.
It's not too difficult, dear. It shouldn't take long for you and Geryon to get the knack of it.
What do you think?
Queen Porin asked Javelin.
It is dangerous, he told her. Very dangerous. Do we have any choice? Not that I can think of right offhand.
Well, that's it, then, Geryon said. If the rest of you will tell the troops what we're going to do, Drennic and I can start learning how to build imaginary bonfires.
It was perhaps an hour later, when the Riven troops moved out tensely, each man walking through the gray-green gorse with his hand close to his weapon. The low range of hills lay dark ahead of them, and the weedy track they followed led directly into the boulder-strewn ravine, where the unseen bear cultists waited in ambush. Geryon steeled himself as they entered that ravine, drawing in his will and carefully remembering everything Aunt Paul had taught him. The plan worked surprisingly well. As the first group of cultists dashed from the concealment of their gully with their weapons aloft and shouts of triumph on their lips, Geryon, Durnik, and Polgara instantly blocked the mouths of the other three gullies. The charging cult members faltered, their triumph changing to chagrin, as they gaped at the sudden flames that prevented their comrades from joining the fray. Geryon's Rivens moved immediately to take advantage of that momentary hesitation. Step by step, the first group of cultists were pushed back into the narrow confines of the gully that had concealed them. Geryon could pay only scant attention to the progress of the fight. He sat astride his horse with Leldoran at his side, concentrating entirely upon projecting the images of flames and the sense of heat and the crackle of fire across the mouth of the gully opposite the one where the fight was in progress. Dimly, through the leaping flames, he could see the members of the cult trying to shield their faces from an intense heat that was not really there. And then, the one thing that had not occurred to any of them happened. The trapped cult members in Geryon's gully began to throw buckets full of water, hastily dipped from a stagnant pond on the imaginary flames. There was, of course, no hiss of steam nor any other visible effect of that attempt to quench the illusion. After several moments, a cult member, cringing and wincing, stepped through the fire.
"It isn't real,"
he shouted back over his shoulder.
"The fire's not real."
"This is, though," Leldoran muttered grimly, sinking an arrow into the man's chest. The cultist threw up his arms and toppled over backward into the fire, which had no effect on his limp body. That, of course, gave the whole thing away. First a few, and then a score or more cult members ran directly through Geryon's illusion. Leldoran's hands blurred as he shot arrow after arrow into the milling ranks at the mouth of the gully.
"There are too many of them, Geryon. I cannot hold them. We will have to fall back," he shouted.
"Aunt Paul," Geryon yelled, "they're breaking through."
"Push them back," she called to him. "Use your will."
He concentrated even more and pushed a solid barrier of his will at the men emerging from the gully. At first it seemed that it might even work, but the effort he was exerting was enormous, and he soon began to tire. The edges of his hastily erected barrier began to fray and tatter, and the men he was trying so desperately to hold back began to find those weak spots. Dimly, even as he bent all of his concentration on maintaining the barrier, he heard a sullen rumble, almost like distant thunder.
"Geryon," Leldoran cried. "Horsemen! Hundreds of them!"
In dismay, Geryon looked quickly up the ravine and saw a sudden horde of riders coming down the steep cut from the east.
"Aunt Paul!" he shouted, even as he reached back over his shoulder to draw Iron Grip's great sword. The wave of riders, however, veered sharply just as they reached him and crashed directly into the front ranks of the cultists who were on the verge of breaking through his barrier. This new force was composed of lean, leather-tough men in black, and their eyes had a peculiar angularity to them.
"Nodrax,
By the gods, they're Nadrags!
Garion heard Beric shout from somewhere across the ravine.
What are they doing here?
Garion muttered, half to himself.
Garion!
Lothurin exclaimed.
That man in the middle of the riders, is that not Prince Keldar?
The new troops charging into the furious melee quickly turned the tide of battle. They charged directly into the faces of the startled cultists who were emerging from the mouths of the gullies, inflicting dreadful casualties. Once he had committed his horsemen, Silk dropped back to join Garion and Lothurin in the center of the ravine.
Good day, gentlemen, he greeted them with aplomb. I hope I did not keep you waiting.
Where did you get all of the Nadrags?
Garion demanded, trembling with sudden relief.
In Garhag Nadrak, of course.
Why would they want to help us?
Oh, because I paid them, Silk shrugged. You owe me a great deal of money, Garion.
How did you find so many so fast?
Yarblek and I have a fur trading station just across the border. The trappers who brought in their furs last spring were just lying around drinking and gambling, and so I hired them.
You got here just in time.
I noticed that. Those fires of yours were a nice touch.
Up until the point where they started throwing water on them, that's when things started to get tense.
A few hundred of the trapped cultists managed to escape the general destruction by scrambling up the steep sides of the gullies and fleeing out onto the barren moors. But for most of their fellows, there was no escape. Beric rode out of the gully where the Riven troops were mopping up the few survivors of the initial charge.
"Do you want to give them a chance to surrender?" he asked Garion.
Garion remembered the conversation he and Polgara had had several days previously.
"I suppose we should," he said after a moment's thought.
"You don't have to, you know. Under the circumstances, no one would blame you if you wiped them out to the very last man."
No, Garion said. I don't think I really want to do that. Tell the ones that are left that we'll spare their lives if they throw down their weapons.
Beric shrugged.
It's up to you.
Silk, you're a lying little thief,
a tall Nadrak in a felt coat and an outrageous fur hat exclaimed. He was roughly searching the body of a slain cultist.
You said that they all had money on them, and that they were loaded down with gold chains and bracelets. All this one has on him is fleas.
Perhaps I exaggerated just a trifle, Yarblek, Silk said urbanely to his partner.
I ought to gut you, do you know that?
Why, Yarblek, Silk replied with feigned astonishment. Is that any way to talk to your brother?
Brother?
The Nadrak snorted, rising and planting a solid kick in the side of the body that had so sorely disappointed him.
That's what we agreed when we went into this partnership, that we were going to treat each other like brothers.
Don't twist words on me, you little weasel. Besides, I stuck a knife in my brother 20 years ago for lying to me.
As the last of the trapped and outnumbered cultists threw down their arms in surrender, Polgara, Tinedra, and Erand came cautiously up the ravine, accompanied by the filthy, hunchbacked Belden.
"Your Algar reinforcements are still several days away," the ugly little sorcerer told Garion. "I tried to hurry them along. They're very tender-hearted with their horses. Where did you get all these Nadraks?"
"Silk hired them."
Belden nodded approvingly.
"Mercenaries! Always make the best soldiers," he said.
The coarse-faced Yarblek had been looking at Polgara, his eyes alight with recognition.
"You're still as handsome as ever, girl," he said to her. "Have you changed your mind about letting me buy you?"
"No, Yarblek. Not yet, anyway. You arrived at an excellent time."
"Only because some lying little thief told me there was loot to be had."
He glared at Silk and then nudged the body he was standing over with his foot.
"Frankly, I would make more money plucking dead chickens."
Belden looked at Garion.
If you intend to see your son again before he has a full beard, you'd better get moving.
I've got to make some arrangements about the prisoners, Geryon replied.
What's to arrange?
Yarblek shrugged.
Line them up and chop off their heads.
Absolutely not.
What's the point of fighting if you can't butcher the prisoners when it's over?
Someday, when we have some time, I'll explain it to you, Silk told him.
Ah, Alorns,
Yarblek sighed, casting his eyes toward the murky sky.
Yarblek, you mangy son of a dog?
It was a raven-haired woman in leather breeches and a tight-fitting leather vest. There was at once a vast anger and an overwhelming physical presence about her.
I thought you said we could make a profit by picking over the dead. These vermin don't have a thing on them.
We were misled, Vela,
he replied somberly, giving Silk a flinty look.
I told you not to trust that rat-faced little sneak. You're not only ugly, Yarblek, you're stupid as well.
Geryon had been looking curiously at this angry woman.
Isn't that the girl who danced in the tavern that time in Garognadrak?
He asked Silk, remembering the girl's overwhelming sensuality that had stirred the blood of every man in that wayside drinking establishment. The little man nodded.
She married that trapper Tech, but he came out second best in an argument with a bear a few years back, and his brother sold her to Yarblek.
Worst mistake I ever made, Yarblek said mournfully. She is almost as fast with her knives as she is with her tongue.
He pulled back one sleeve and showed them an angry red scar.
And all I was trying to do was to be friendly.
She laughed.
Ha! You know the rules, Yarblek. If you want to keep your guts on the inside, you keep your hands to yourself.
Belden's eyes had a peculiar expression in them as he looked at her.
Yeah. Spirited wench, isn't she?
He murmured to Yarblek.
I admire a woman with quick wit and a ready tongue.
A wild hope suddenly flared in Yarblek's eyes.
You like her?
He asked eagerly.
I will sell her to you if you want.
Have you lost your mind entirely, Yarblek?
Vela demanded indignantly.
Please, Vela, I am talking business.
This shabby old troll couldn't buy a tankard of cheap ale, much less me.
She turned to Belden.
Have you even got 2 coins to rub together, you jackass?
She demanded of him.
Now you've gone and spoiled the whole negotiation,
Yarblek accused her plaintively. Belden, however, gave the dark-haired woman a wicked, lopsided grin.
You interest me, girl. Nobody's done that for longer than I can remember. Try to work on your threats and curses a bit, though. The rhythm isn't quite right.
He turned to Polgara.
I think I'll go and see what those Dresdian pikemen are up to. Somehow I don't believe that we want them creeping up behind us.
Then he spread his arms, crouched, and became a hawk. Vela stared incredulously after him as he soared away.
How did he do that?
She gasped.
Oh, he's very talented, Silk replied.
He is indeed.
She turned on Yarblek with a fire in her eyes.
Why did you let me talk to him like that?
She demanded.
You know how important first impressions are. Now he'll never make a decent offer for me.
You can tell for yourself that he doesn't have any money.
There are other things than money, Yarblek.
Yarblek shook his head and walked away, muttering to himself. Tenedra's eyes were as hard and as green as agates.
Geryon?
She said in a deceptively quiet voice.
One day very soon, we will want to talk about these taverns you mentioned, and dancing girls, and a few other matters as well.
It was a long time ago, dear, he said quickly.
Not nearly long enough. Does anybody have anything to eat?
Vela demanded, looking around.
I'm as hungry as a bitch wolf with 10 puppies.
I can probably find something for you, Polgara replied. Vela looked at her and her eyes slowly widened.
Are you who I think you are?
She asked in an awed voice.
That depends on who you think I am, dear,
I understand that you dance,
Tenedra said, in a chilly voice. Vela shrugged.
All women dance. I am just the best, that's all. You seem very sure of yourself, Mistress Vela. I just recognize facts.
Vela looked curiously at Tenedra.
My, you are a tiny one, aren't you?
She asked.
Are you really full-grown? I am the Queen of Riva,
Tenedra replied, drawing herself up to her full height.
Ah, oh, good for you, girl,
Vela said warmly, clapping her on the shoulder.
I always enjoy seeing a woman getting ahead.
It was mid-morning of a gray, cloudy day when Geryon crested a hill and looked across a shallow valley at the imposing bulk of Rehon. The town stood atop a steep hill, and its walls reared up sharply out of the rank gorse, covering the slopes.
Well, Beric said quietly as he joined Geryon. There it is.
I didn't realize the walls were quite so high, Geryon admitted.
They've been working on them, Beric said, pointing. You can see that new stonework on the parapet.
Flying defiantly above the city, the scarlet banner of the bear cult, a blood-red flag with the black outline of a shambling bear in the center, snapped in the chill breeze. For some reason, that flag raised an almost irrational rage in Geryon.
I want that thing down, he said, from between clenched teeth.
That's why we came, Beric told him.
Mandaralan, burnished in his armor, joined them.
This isn't going to be easy, is it? Geryon said to them.
It won't be so bad, Beric replied, once Hertar gets here.
Mandaralan had been assessing the town's fortifications with a professional eye.
I foresee no insurmountable difficulties, he declared confidently. Immediately upon the return of the several hundred men I dispatched to procure timbers from the forest lying some leagues to the north, I shall begin the construction of the siege engines.
Can you actually throw a rock big enough to knock a hole in walls that thick?
Geryon asked dubiously.
"'Tis not a single stroke that reduces them, Geryon,' the knight replied. "'It is the repetition of blow after blow. "'I will ring the town with engines and rain stones upon their walls. "'I doubt not that there will be a breach or two ere my Lord Hetor arrives.'
"'Won't the people inside repair them as fast as you break them?'
"'Not if you've got other catapults throwing burning pitch at them.' It's very hard to concentrate on anything when you're on fire, Beric said.
Geryon winced.
I hate using fire on people, he said, briefly remembering Asherak, the Murgo.
It is the only way, Geryon. Otherwise, you're going to lose a lot of good men.
Geryon sighed. All right, let's get started then. Reinforced by Yarblick's trappers, the Rivens drew up in a wide circle around the fortified town. Though their combined numbers were not yet sufficient to mount a successful assault on the high, grim walls, they were, nonetheless, enough to seal the town effectively. The construction of Mandaralan's siege engines took but a few days. Once they were completed and moved into position, the steady twang of tightly twisted ropes uncoiling with terrific force, and the sharp crack of heavy rocks shattering against the walls of Rehon was almost continual. Geryon watched from a vantage point atop a nearby hill as rock after rock lofted high into the air to smash down on those seemingly impregnable walls.
"It is a sad thing to watch,"
Queen Porin noted as she joined him. A stiff breeze tugged at her black gown and stirred her flaxen hair as she moodily watched Mandaralan's engines pounding relentlessly at the walls of Rehon.
Rehon has stood here for almost 3,000 years. It has been like a rock guarding our frontier. It seems very strange to attack one of my own cities, particularly when you consider the fact that half of our forces are Nadrax, the very people Rehon was built to hold off in the first place.
Wars are always a little absurd, Porin, Garion agreed.
More than just a little. Oh, Bulgara asked me to tell you that Belden has come back. He has something to tell you.
All right. Shall we go back down, then? He offered the Queen of Thrasnia his arm. Belden was lounging on the grass near the tents, gnawing the shreds of meat off of a soup bone and exchanging casual insults with Vella.
"You've got a bit of a problem, Belgarion," he said. "Those Drasnian pikemen have broken camp and they are marching this way."
Garion frowned.
"How far away is Hedhar?"
"Far enough to turn it into a race," the little hunchback replied. "I expect that the whole outcome's going to depend upon which army gets here first."
"The Drasnians wouldn't really attack us, would they?"
Tenedra asked.
"It is hard to say,"
Porin replied.
"If Haldar has convinced them that Garion is holding me prisoner, they might. Javelin took a horse and rode back to see if he could find out exactly what's going on."
Garion began to pace up and down, gnawing worriedly on one fingernail.
"Don't bite your nails, dear,"
Polgara told him.
"Yes, ma'am,"
he replied automatically, still lost in thought. "Is Hedhar coming as fast as he can?" he asked Belden.
"He's pushing his horses about as hard as they can be pushed."
"If there was only some way to slow down those pikemen."
"I've got a couple of ideas," Belden said.
He looked at Polgara.
"What do you say to a bit of flying, Paul?"
he asked.
"I might need some help with this."
"I don't want you to hurt those men," Queen Porin said firmly. "They are my people, even if they are being misled."
"If what I've got in mind works, nobody's going to get hurt,"
Belden reassured her. He rose to his feet and dusted off the back of his filthy tunic.
"I've enjoyed chatting with you, girl," he said to Vella.
She unleashed a string of expletives at him that turned Tenedra's face pale.
"Ah, you're getting better at that," he approved. "I think you're starting to get the hang of it. Coming, Paul?"
Vella's expression was indecipherable as she watched the blue-banded hawk and the snowy owl spiraling upward.